From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Just as kindness was a weakness in my family, so too was admitting mistakes. And I think over time, Donald has gone from refusing to admit mistakes to truly believing he's never wrong.
Today, we spend the hour with the author of a book President Trump doesn't want you to read. It's called Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. It's written by Trump's niece, Mary Trump, a clinical psychologist. She describes Donald Trump as a sociopath who grew up in a dysfunctional family that fostered his greed and cruelty, which he is now inflicting on the world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. coronavirus death toll is on pace to reach nearly 300,000 by December, according to an influential model by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. But the Institute projects 66,000 lives could be saved if 95% of people in the United States wear face coverings. The U.S. death toll currently stands at 160,000, by far the highest total in the world. On Thursday, the United States recorded more than 2,000 new coronavirus deaths, the highest daily figure since May. This comes as Arkansas, Montana, Nevada, North Carolina, and Puerto Rico all reported new records for COVID-19 deaths over the past week. In Georgia, two high school students have been suspended after they published images of classmates ignoring social distancing guidelines and not wearing masks in crowded hallways at North Paulding High School in Dallas, Georgia. 15-year-old sophomore Hannah Waters says she was ordered to remain home from school for 5 days after she tweeted a photo and a video of unmasked students crowding her school's hallways on the second day of the new school year. She told CNN, and then her only aim was to call attention to unsafe conditions.
Concerned for the safety of everyone in that building and everyone in the county, because precautions that the CDC and guidelines that the CDC has been telling us for months now weren't being followed.
During a Paulding County School District meeting in May, Board Chair Jeff Fuller said coronavirus guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control were unfair because the disease was, quote, not affecting students.
I don't like to use this language, but those CDC guidelines, in my opinion, are complete crap. I want us as a school district in Paulding County to lead the way in an absolute normal return to normal activities on August 3rd, if we are allowed to by law, without buying into the hype.
The Georgia school district superintendent has called masks a personal choice and says they're encouraged but not required at school. There's widespread community transmission of coronavirus in Paulding County, and at least one teacher has resigned rather than risk in-person classes. India has become the third country after the U.S. and Brazil to record 2 million confirmed coronavirus cases after reporting a record 62,000 new infections Thursday. The number of cases in India has doubled over the past 3 weeks. The number of confirmed cases in Africa has surpassed 1 million, with more than half of those in South Africa. But the total is widely believed to be a vast undercount due to a shortage of tests. The World Health Organization says the peak of the pandemic has yet to come in Africa. In Mexico, the death toll has topped 50,000, the world's third highest total behind the United States and Brazil. In Peru, the death toll has reached 20,000. Peruvian doctors warn the country's health system is overwhelmed.
We're overcrowded. We have no staff, no doctors, no nurses, no medication, no personal protective equipment, no oxygen. What do we do?
On Capitol Hill, talks between House Democrats and Republican leaders on a new coronavirus stimulus bill are on the brink of collapse more than a week after enhanced unemployment benefits and a federal moratorium on evictions expired. Meanwhile, Saturday marks the deadline for businesses to apply to the $650 billion Paycheck Protection Program of guaranteed federal loans. The Labor Department reported Thursday 1.2 million U.S. workers filed for state unemployment benefits last week, the lowest total since March, but still an extraordinary mandatory level by historical standards. On Thursday, Senators Bernie Sanders, Ed Markey, and Kirsten Gillibrand introduced the Make Billionaires Pay Act, a 60% tax on over $700 billion in windfall profits made this year by the top 0.001% of Americans. Senator Sanders wrote, quote, "We can continue to allow the very rich to get much richer while everyone else gets poorer and poorer, or we can tax the winnings a handful of billionaires made during the pandemic to improve the health and well-being of tens of millions of Americans," Sanders said. The United Nations is warning of a humanitarian catastrophe in Lebanon following Tuesday's massive explosion at the port of Beirut that killed at least 157 people, injured 5,000 others, and left 300,000 homeless. French President Emmanuel Macron visited Beirut on Thursday and said France was ready to aid Lebanon, but only if officials enact reforms cracking down on widespread corruption. On Thursday, Lebanese police fired tear gas at anti-government protesters who gathered outside the parliament. There are plans for a massive mobilization Saturday calling for the ouster and arrest of Lebanese officials who allowed thousands of tons of unsecured, highly explosive ammonium nitrate fertilizer to remain unsecured at the port of Beirut for 6 years leading up to Tuesday's blast. Here in New York, Attorney General Letitia James filed a lawsuit Thursday against the National Rifle Association seeking to dissolve the gun lobby group over what she called a culture of self-dealing, mismanagement, and negligent oversight that was illegal, oppressive, and fraudulent. James said the NRA's chief executive officer, Wayne LaPierre, and other top officials broke state and federal laws while enriching themselves and their families.
Mr. LaPierre exploited the organization for his and his family's financial benefit and the benefit of a close circle of NRA staff, board members, and vendors. Specifically, Mr. LaPierre spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of the NRA's charitable assets for personal private plane trips for himself and his family, including extended family when he was not present.
The lawsuit seeks to remove LaPierre and other top executives from the NRA and to bar them from ever serving on a nonprofit board in New York again. LaPierre and the NRA are major supporters of President Trump. In Ohio, President Trump Thursday accused campaign rival Joe Biden of being against God, guns, and fossil fuel energy. Trump was speaking to supporters after arriving at an airport in Cleveland.
He's following the radical left agenda. Take away your guns, destroy your Second Amendment, no religion, no anything, hurt the Bible, hurt God.
On Thursday, the Commission on Presidential Debates rejected a request by the Trump campaign to hold a fourth debate with Joe Biden and to move the first debate up to the first week of September. Republican Governor Mike DeWine of Ohio tested positive for the coronavirus on Thursday afternoon, but then said another test last night came back negative. DeWine took the initial test ahead of a scheduled meeting with President Trump in Cleveland. Anyone who comes in contact with President Trump is tested. But as President Trump pushes to reopen economies and schools all over the country, there is a severe lack of access to tests nationwide. The State Department has announced Elliot Abrams will become the administration's new special representative for Iran. Abrams will also continue as special representative for Venezuela, where he's led the Trump administration's unsuccessful efforts to topple the Venezuelan government. In 1991, Elliot Abrams was convicted of lying to Congress during the Iran-Contra scandal, but he was later pardoned by President George H.W. Bush. Abrams defended Guatemalan dictator General Efrain Rios Montt as he oversaw a campaign of mass murder and torture of indigenous people in Guatemala in the 1980s. Rios Montt was later convicted of genocide. Abrams was also linked to the 2002 attempted coup against Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. The peace group Code Pink slammed Elliot Abrams' new appointment, saying, quote, "The dangerous conflict resulting from Trump's withdrawal from the nuclear agreement will be exacerbated by a man committed to Washington's failed policies of regime change." On Capitol Hill, President Trump's nominee for a top Pentagon post was grilled Thursday over his company's alleged ties to the Saudi hit squad that assassinated journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Lewis Bramer, a former Navy SEAL turned investment banker, sits on the board of directors of a military training company named Tier One Group. Last year, Washington Post columnist David Ignatius revealed the CIA warned other U.S. government agencies that Tier 1 employees may have trained some of Khashoggi's killers. On Thursday, Senator Tim Kaine asked Bramer about the allegations.
I do know that we train Saudi nationals as part of our engagements with the kingdom. As an allied nation, we train other nations as well, but I have no knowledge of that.
So until today, you had not been aware that an allegation had been made that a company on which you sit as a director with a small board of directors had potentially been involved in training Saudis who were participants in the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi?
Senator, I don't have any recollection of that.
Meanwhile, a former top Saudi intelligence official exiled in Canada said in a lawsuit filed Thursday that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman sent a hit squad to Toronto to hunt him down and kill him. The 106-page complaint was filed by Saad al-Jabri in U.S. civil court. It claims that Prince bin Salman tried to hide his corrupt business dealings by ordering al-Jabri's assassination. President Trump has issued two sweeping executive orders that would essentially ban the use of the Chinese-owned apps TikTok and WeChat in the United States in 45 days, citing national security reasons. More than 100 million people in the U.S. have downloaded TikTok, a viral video service. WeChat is a widely used app by Chinese Americans for messaging and other services. China condemned the orders as a, quote, nakedly hegemonic act. The executive orders come as the Trump administration has been actively working to help Microsoft purchased some of TikTok's overseas operations. BuzzFeed reports Facebook deleted misinformation warnings against high-profile right-wing pages and reportedly fired an employee who collected evidence of Facebook giving such pages preferential treatment. This comes as Facebook employees have repeatedly questioned Facebook executives over their handling of right-wing, white supremacist media outlets that publish fake news. In one instance, the company allowed Breitbart News, which is a Facebook news partner, to circulate a video promoting unproven treatments for COVID-19 and discourage wearing face masks. In sports news, players of the Women's National Basketball Association are urging fans to elect Georgia Senate Democratic candidate Reverend Raphael Warnock in November. Warnock is seeking to unseat Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler, co-owner of the WNBA's franchise, the Atlanta Dream. On Tuesday night, several players arriving at the league's coronavirus bubble in Florida were spotted wearing black T-shirts that read, "Vote Warnock," in white letters. This comes after Senator Loeffler, a white woman and supporter of President Trump, slammed the WNBA's racial justice initiative for the 2020 season, saying any alignment with the Black Lives Matter movement sends a message of exclusion as they seek to defund the police. Loeffler claimed in a recent letter to the WNBA, the players, quote, called for the removal of Jesus from churches and promoted violence and destruction across the country, Loeffler wrote. A federal judge in California has ordered Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to establish rapid on-site COVID-19 testing and to set up a dormitory for coronavirus-positive prisoners at the Mesa Verde Detention Center in Bakersfield. Thursday's order follows a coronavirus outbreak that hospitalized two prisoners and infected at least seven others. The ruling cites disturbing emails between ICE officials and the GEO Group, the for-profit private prison company that runs Mesa Verde. In one email, a clinical operations specialist, a healthcare company that provides services to ICE, says, quote, testing all detainees will potentially cause the same housing issue we had last week, but on a larger scale. Completing the testing is not the issue. It's just what will we need to do with the results once they're received, unquote. Over 4,100 prisoners have tested positive for COVID-19 at ICE prisons across the United States. In more immigration news, two men in the custody of ICE died Wednesday, making this fiscal year the deadliest for immigrants in ICE custody since 2006. Meanwhile, the Trump administration's dramatically increasing fees for dozens of immigration and work visa applications. This includes a more than 80% increase on naturalization applications, which will now cost over $1,000. There will also be an unprecedented $50 fee for asylum applications. The new fees go into effect in October. And San Quentin State Prison in California has become the site of the largest coronavirus outbreak in the country, overtaking the Marion Correctional Institution in Ohio. 22 San Quentin prisoners have died from COVID-19. Over 2,200 prisoners and 260 staff have tested positive for COVID-19. This comes as advocates continue to pressure California Governor Gavin Newsom to grant mass release to halt the further spread of the virus inside prisons. Democracy Now! Spoke to incarcerated journalist Juan Haynes, who's himself recovering from COVID-19 earlier this week, about conditions where he is jailed inside San Quentin.
The architectural design of California prisons are not fit for human occupation. It's just not. That's why so many people in San Quentin are dying, because we can't physically distance ourselves from each other. And what's so hurtful about this fact that we can't physically distance from each other, so any type of contagion that gets inside of this prison is going to spread like wildfire.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. When we come back, we spend the hour with the author of a book President Trump doesn't want you to read. It's called Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. The author, Mary Trump, is President Trump's niece. She joins us in a minute. Das Rheingold. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. Today, we spend the hour with the author of a book President Trump doesn't want you to read. Mary Trump is the niece of President Donald Trump, a clinical psychologist, author of Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. She describes Donald Trump as a sociopath who grew up in a dysfunctional family that fostered his greed and cruelty, which he is now inflicting on the world. Donald Trump's younger brother, Robert, attempted to block the sale of the book on behalf of the Trump family, saying it violated a confidentiality agreement. But a New York judge ruled against him. The book was published in July, and Mary Trump was allowed to speak about it. Too Much and Never Enough sold more copies in a week than Trump's Art of the Deal did in 29 years. Yes, Mary Trump's book sold nearly 1 million copies in one day, the publication date. In her book, Dr. Mary Trump writes, quote, "The out-of-control COVID-19 pandemic, the possibility of an economic depression, deepening social divides along political lines, thanks to Donald's penchant for division and devastating uncertainty about our country's future, have created a perfect storm of catastrophes that no one is less equipped than my uncle to manage," she writes. The U.S. coronavirus death toll now stands at 160,000, by far the highest total in the world. Some estimates say it could rise to 300,000 by the end of the year. Dr. Mary Trump, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Well, you have said that your uncle, President Trump, should face criminal charges for his response to the pandemic. Explain.
It's hard at this point to give him any slack for not having acted. You know, we now know what to do to mitigate the spread of this very infectious disease. And he's not only not doing those things, he's actively advocating against them still and continuing to claim that it's just going to disappear. It's still some kind of hoax, using the racist term China virus to get himself off the hook. And with over 160,000 Americans dead and rising, how can we not assume that there's some kind of culpability here? And you know, he is able to make steps to fix this problem, and since he's not doing it, that to me also suggests criminal culpability.
So you say so much in this book. Give us a kind of deep background on the Trump family and Donald Trump himself that we've ever read or seen. If you can talk about why you wrote Too Much and Never Enough.
I wrote this book primarily to give people the kind of information they did not have access to in 2016. And there are reasons I wasn't able to do that in 2016. Having to do partially with, you know, nothing he did or said seemed to turn anybody off anyway. So I'm not entirely sure that my saying anything would matter. So in 2020, there's so much more at stake than there ever has been. I believe that this country is on the knife's edge. And I don't want anybody going to cast their vote in November being able to claim that they just don't know who they're voting for.
So tell us about your family. You are the daughter of Donald Trump's older brother, Freddie Trump, who died at a young age. Take us back to your family as you talk about and quote, Victor Hugo of Les Miserables, talking about deep darkness. I wanted to share that quote if you want to talk a little about it.
Sure.
The book opening with that quote that says, "If the soul is left in darkness, sins will be committed. The guilty one is not he who commits the sin, but the one who causes the darkness." The epigraph, clearly a reference to what Fred Trump, your grandfather, you say, did to Donald Trump.
Yeah, I chose that quote specifically for that reason, but also because I think it works in the present day. You know, I think a lot of people in this country are purposely left in the dark and making bad decisions and self-defeating decisions because they are not given access to information that would help them make better choices. But as far as my grandfather, he was basically the only person in the family whose opinion mattered. He had all of the power. You know, it was a very patriarchal system I grew up in. There was a lot of misogyny, so being a girl in that family was an automatic strike against you. And my grandfather was the kind of man who believed in dynasty, in a way. I mean, he wouldn't have put it in those terms, but, you know, he had his real estate empire, and his oldest son and namesake, my father, was going to be his successor, and his empire was going to last in perpetuity. Unfortunately, for my father's sake, he wasn't the right kind of person in my grandfather's eyes. My grandfather needed somebody who was a killer, who was a tough guy, somebody who would win at all costs and was not weak in any way. In my family, being kind was considered being weak. Admitting your mistakes and apologizing for them was equated with weakness as well. So I don't know exactly when it happened, but at some point, certainly I would imagine by the time my dad was in college, my grandfather already knew that he was probably not going to cut it as his heir apparent. So Donald who was 7.5 years younger, learned from my grandfather's psychological and emotional abuse of my dad. And the message was essentially, don't be like Freddie. And since my grandfather ran my family as a zero-sum game, and there could only be one winner and everybody else was a loser, Donald was determined to win. And he, in my grandfather's eyes at least, did, and, you know, successfully auditioned as my dad's replacement.
I wanted to ask you about a New York Times report long ago, in 1927, that your grandfather, Donald Trump's father, Fred Trump, was arrested at a Ku Klux Klan riot in Queens, New York. The article is subtitled "Klan Assails Policemen." It reports that 1,000 Klansmen and 100 policemen staged a free-for-all battle. It lists Fred Trump, with his address, as one of 7 men who were arrested and arraigned for the assault. Charges against him were dropped. New York Police Commissioner Warren is quoted in the article saying the Klan not only wore gowns, but had hoods over their faces, almost completely hiding their identity. The report was found and published in 2015 by the website Boing Boing. In a New York Times interview about the discovery, your uncle, Donald Trump, said, "I saw that it was one little website that said it. It never happened. They said there were no charges, no nothing. It's unfair to mention it, to be honest, because there were no charges. They said there were charges against other people, but there were absolutely no charges. Totally false," he said. But we're going back to that 2017 report in the New York Times. Do you know about this, Mary Trump? Did you hear about it as you were growing up?
No, I didn't. Although, you know, my family wasn't great at telling stories. But unlike Donald, I don't doubt the validity of the report. It would be kind of a random thing to make up 60 years ago or 80 years ago, whenever it was. The only thing that surprises me, because, you know, my family was quite anti-Semitic, along with other things. So the only thing that surprises me is that my grandfather would take time away from his business to go to anything, honestly. But it wouldn't surprise me that he shared the sentiments.
You say that Donald Trump and your family were anti-Semitic were racist. Can you give us examples, particularly of President Trump, as you knew him growing up?
Yeah, you know, I can't, because it was just the way it was, honestly. It was sort of the background. You know, the terms were thrown about rather casually. And, you know, I don't want to suggest that, like, there was this sense of virulence in the household, but, you know, it was just language that was used, and it was a given. So I can't think of any specific examples. I mean, if I could, that would suggest that it didn't happen very often, you know.
Did you ever hear Donald Trump, your uncle, use the N-word?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure.
Well, you know, I know that sounds awful to put it that way, but when you live in a family and, you know, you're a kid, it's not that I didn't know it was wrong. I did, because I lived a very different kind of experience growing up. You know, I lived in Jamaica, Queens, which was, you know, lower class, working class and predominantly African-American. I went to a school that was predominantly Jewish. So I didn't understand the animus, but it wasn't shocking, because it's just the way it was. This is how adults in my orbit spoke and behaved. And now, of course, I learned a long time ago that it wasn't just something I disagreed with, but it was deeply wrong. I guess I say it the way I say it is just to underscore how casual and accepted it was.
So I wanted to then go to the 1970s. Your father was being sidelined in the Trump organization, though it does sound like he very much didn't want to really do that job. He loved flying, and I want to ask you about him in a minute. But Donald Trump came to the fore very quickly, became president when, what, he was in his early 20s. In 1973, the Department of Justice filed a federal lawsuit against Donald Trump and the company for alleged racial discrimination at Trump housing developments in New York. Again, the Justice Department suing personally Donald Trump, his father, your grandfather, Fred, and Trump management in order to obtain a settlement in which Trump and his father would promise not to discriminate. It was settled like 2 years later, after Trump tried to countersue the Justice Department for $100 million for making false statements, allegations all dismissed by the court. Yeah. Can you, Mary Trump, talk about what you understood, what happened at that time?
Well, I was eight, so I'm not entirely sure I would have been aware of it. I do remember my dad was worried. He wasn't in the, you know, he wasn't working for my grandfather's company anymore. But, you know, I know at that time he was worried about this lawsuit. And, you know, shortly before that, or a couple of years before that, my grandfather had been involved with the Tomasellos, which allegedly had mafia ties and that might have gotten my grandfather into trouble. And I know my dad was worried about that as well, but he was outside of it. So I didn't have any access into what was really going on until much later. And I essentially know what other people know about what happened and how, you know, bringing Roy Cohn into the mix kind of changed the course a little bit of where Donald was heading.
So if you could talk about your family, going back in time as we backtrack, give us a family, kind of family tree. What's interesting is Donald Trump has continually said, not clear why, Fred Trump, his father, your grandfather, was born in Germany. Now, your grandmother was, but it wasn't just a misstatement where he said it once and maybe meant his own grandfather. He has continually said that his father was born in Germany. Can you understand why?
It's really fascinating what Donald gets wrong sometimes. And, you know, it's difficult on occasion to know if he's doing it on purpose or not. That confuses me. He used to say that he was Swedish. You know, when asked what his ethnicity was, he would say Swedish because, you know, the excuse given was that they worked with a lot of Jewish people and they didn't want to offend them by admitting to his German roots. But my grandmother was Scottish, so he could have said Scottish. So it's never really clear why, you know, he must know that his own father was born in the United States. Maybe it is, you know, my grandmother was born in Scotland. She was an immigrant. I honestly can't tell you. It's very weird.
Right. I meant to say your grandmother was. How did your grandmother come here from Scotland? And how did she meet your grandfather? And then talk about that relationship shaping Donald, which we can then take to when you went to the White House and that picture missing, perhaps, from the White House of the family gallery. And that's the picture of Donald Trump's mother.
That's right. Yeah. My grandmother was the youngest of 10 who grew up on a very tiny island off the northwest coast of Scotland. Not exactly a pleasant environment. It was a very harsh place to live in the early 20th century. It's beautiful, but it must have been extremely difficult to live there all those years ago. So she came to the United States to join two of her older sisters who were already here. And I think both of them were already married at the time to American men. And I think she came in part because the male population on the Isle of Lewis had been decimated by World War One, the 1918 pandemic, and a horrible shipwreck off the coast at the end of World War One. So she came as a domestic servant, I believe, and she met my grandfather at a dance very shortly after she arrived. And, you know, family lore says that my grandfather, who was living with his mother at the time, went home after the dance and told her that he had found the woman he was going to marry, and which he did. But it was 5 years later, which seemed, I never found out why it took so long. But anyway, they got married. And very shortly started having a family. And my grandfather by that time was already very, very successful. And that never, you know, that trajectory never changed direction. He got more successful and more wealthy every year. But when Donald was 2.5, my grandmother got very ill. By that point, all five of their children had already been born. Marianne was the oldest, then my dad, my Aunt Elizabeth, Donald, and 1.5 years later, Robert, who was 9 months old when my grandmother became ill. She was essentially absent for almost a year. She had suffered very severe postpartum issues after my Uncle Robert was born that had gone undetected for so long that they were life-threatening. And that was the first major experience that shaped Donald. He experienced her absence as an abandonment. And my grandfather, who was straight-up sociopath, was incapable and unwilling to fulfill the caregiver role. So Donald was very lonely and very frightened at an extremely crucial developmental period. So, you know, he was never able to make up the deficits that occurred at that time. And I think my grandmother, even to the extent she got better, was never able to heal the rifts between them, because although clearly it wasn't her fault that she got ill, she never really took responsibility for, you know, making it up to him and helping him heal that sense of abandonment. And then I think by the time he was sent to the military academy at 13, and my grandmother did absolutely nothing to prevent it, I think that was the final betrayal as far as he was concerned. So it wasn't surprising to me when I visited the White House in April 2017 that the only picture he had on the sideboard behind the Resolute desk was a picture of my grandfather, kind of at the height of his powers, and nobody else. So my Aunt Marianne pointed out to Donald that he should maybe have a picture of their mother on the desk, too. And he basically said, yeah, that's a great idea. Somebody get me a picture of Mom. And what I find very interesting is that the picture I've seen that he has on his desk is a picture of my grandmother before she had even met my grandfather. So it's a picture of Donald's mother before she was his mother.
You mentioned that Donald Trump went to a military academy for high school. Explain why he went there.
In, I guess it would have been, you know, middle school, I guess. His behavior started to become increasingly belligerent and uncontrollable. So, and it wasn't just at home, it was at school as well. He went to a small school in Forest Hills, which is actually the same school I attended when I was a kid. And my grandfather was on the board of trustees at that school. So I think on the one hand, my grandfather found it annoying that his son was creating problems in a school that he was associated with. But he was also out of control in the house as well. My grandfather worked a lot. He worked 6 days a week, many, many hours a day. So my grandmother was the one who had to deal with the brunt of Donald's disobedience and disrespect towards her. So at one point, somebody suggested to my grandfather that, you know, maybe the New York Military Academy would straighten Donald out. And because at the time, Donald wasn't on my grandfather's radar yet, because, you know, my father was still his primary focus. And because my grandmother would have been quite happy to have him out of the house, he was sent to New York Military Academy, and it was really a punishment. It wasn't like he was being sent to Choate or something.
So he comes back, he goes to Fordham, starts there, and then you make a very serious allegation in your book. You say that he paid another young man to take his SATs. Explain what you know.
This is a story that's known in my family. I've been told this directly on numerous occasions, and it was because Donald, at that time, certainly since the time he was, 12, probably had a very, inflated sense of himself, and Fordham wasn't good enough. You know, he felt he needed a degree commensurate with his hyperbolic self-regard, if you will. So he had heard of Wharton, which I guess already had a good reputation. And while he was at Fordham, though, Marianne did his homework for him.
And Marianne is the retired federal judge from New Jersey.
That's right. And she's about 9 years older. So when Donald was at Fordham, he was living at my grandparents' house, and Marianne was living a few blocks away, already married with a child. And also, when he graduated from high school, he hadn't been accepted into any college. So Fordham was an intermediate step for him, I guess. But because he didn't do his homework himself, I don't know that he had confidence that his grades were good enough to get into the University of Pennsylvania. So just as a way to hedge his bets, he paid a boy in the neighborhood named Joe Shapiro, who was, had a reputation for being a good test taker, to take his SATs, which, as it turns out, wasn't necessary because University of Pennsylvania had a very high acceptance rate at the time. And also my dad's very good friend from St. Paul's, which is where he went to high school, worked in the admissions department at the University of Pennsylvania. So Donald probably would have gone in anyway.
He's made a big deal of having gone to the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. It's very important to him. What did your father call Donald from a young age?
He called him the great I am.
From what, like the age of 12?
Yeah. Which just, goes to show how long this has been going on.
Clearly, President Trump cloaks himself, constantly refers to the military, praising the military. But you also write that Donald Trump and his first wife, Ivana being the mother of Eric, Don Jr. and Ivanka, that Donald Trump and Ivana threatened to disown Donald Trump Jr. if he went into the military?
Yeah. My Uncle Rob told me that story a couple of times years ago. And so I don't find it surprising the way Donald speaks about the military now, simply because I believe in his mind, it's the power of the military and the honor of the military reflects on him, since he's in the Oval Office. But he's never demonstrated any use for it, or he's never valued it before this. My dad was a second lieutenant in the National Guard. Donald has never mentioned that. He, as we all know, got 5 deferments. He could have served his country and chose over and over again not to. So I think whatever he has to say about the military now is because he thinks it reflects on him. As we know, he refers to the generals in the United States military as his generals, which they most certainly are not.
Mary Trump is our guest for the hour. She's the niece of President Donald Trump. She's a clinical psychologist. Her book has just come out, broken every record in the first day of publication, sold a million copies. It's called Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. We'll come back with Mary Trump in a minute. Written by folk singer Woody Guthrie and performed by Ryan Harvey, featuring Ani DiFranco and Tom Morello. Guthrie wrote the song in the 1950s to criticize his landlord at the time. That's right, Woody Guthrie's landlord, Fred Trump, the father of the president and grandfather of our guest, Dr. Mary Trump, who has written the new book, Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. We're turning right now to, well, last month, Fox News, the president's favorite network, and until they criticize him and then he gets angry. Well, Fox News's Chris Wallace asked Trump about your claims, Mary Trump, about your grandfather, Donald Trump's father, Fred Trump.
My father liked to win. My father was a very good man. He was a strong man. It's disgraceful that she said that. She was not exactly a family favorite. We didn't have a lot of respect or like for her. I would have never said that, except she writes a book that's so stupid and so vicious, and it's a lie. My father was a great, wonderful man.
Let me just ask you this question.
This is not a person that I spent very much time with, very little time, and now I'm glad. She's a very scarred person. She was not much of a family person. But look, let me just tell you, my father was, I think he was the most solid person I've ever met. And he was a very good person. He was a very, very good person. He was strong, but he was good. For her to say the kind of things, a psychopath, that he was a psychopath, anybody that knew Fred Trump would call him a psychopath. And you know what? If he was, I would tell you. And I would say, you know, Chris, I was with my father and it was impossible. My father was, he was tough. He was tough on me. He was tough on all of the kids, but tough in a solid sense, in a really good sense. For her to say, I think the word she used was psychopath. What a disgrace. She ought to be ashamed of herself. That book is a lie.
That's Donald Trump saying it's a lie, that you calling your grandfather a psychopath. And, of course, you've called President Trump a sociopath. Can you respond to what he said?
Yeah, first of all, I refer to my grandfather as a sociopath, and I actually don't diagnose Donald specifically. Because I think it's kind of irrelevant, but he certainly exhibits sociopathic behaviors. That's for sure. What is he going to say? Of course he'll deny that my grandfather was a sociopath, but I don't know that you could find many people who knew my grandfather who would say he was a good person, or any for that matter, who weren't related to him. And what to me, what's most telling about that is that, you know, Donald makes it clear that that he didn't spend a lot of time with me. First of all, I was at my grandparents' house all the time. All of the older grandchildren were at my grandparents' house very frequently when we were growing up. But if he didn't spend time with me, since he's my uncle, that would be sort of down to him, you know, not me. But
in fact, he spent enough time with you to ask you to be the ghostwriter for his sequel to The Art of the Deal.
Yes, indeed. So I guess nobody's asked him about that. But I don't know what he would, maybe he would say that he didn't know that I was his niece. So he hired me.
But can you say what he said to you when you were 29 years old and you went to Mar-a-Lago? It was hot outside. You were wearing a bathing suit.
Yeah. We were having, it was just Donald, Marla, and me.
Marla, his second wife.
Yes. We were having lunch on the patio outside, and Mar-a-Lago, it was way before it was a private club, so it was just his place. And despite its, you know, pretentiousness, it was pretty casual. You know, so I felt comfortable coming from the pool with shorts and a bathing suit on. And Donald had his golf clothes on. And as I approached the table where they were already sitting, he looks up at me and it was as if he'd never seen me before. And he said, he swore. Want to make sure I don't do that. He said, "Holy expletive, Mary, you're stacked." Which, you know, I was 29 years old and not easily embarrassed, but that even that shock, even though I had known Donald my whole life, that still shocked me. And it created a bit of awkwardness in the moment. So I quickly just wrapped my towel around myself and sat down and was,
I mean,
mildly horrified.
When you heard that videotape from Access Hollywood where he talks about grabbing women, the P word, and how he can't help himself, talking about bragging about sexually assaulting women. Did that surprise you? And then he won. Can you tell us what your aunt, his sister, the federal judge, Marianne, said to you when you said, "Even with all of this, I fear he's going to win," back in 2016? What did she say to you?
She said, "He's a clown, and there's no way people are going to vote for him." And, I mean, I thought the same thing, honestly. I was just worried after he won the Republican nomination. The fact that he had a 1% chance of winning was too unnerving to me. And then when I said to her, "Yeah, I don't understand it. Like, what has he ever accomplished?" And she said, "Well, he has had 5 bankruptcies." So that was sort of our take on the whole thing. And as for the Access Hollywood tape, I wasn't the slightest bit shocked that he said it, or that he admitted to these things, or that he'd actually done these things. I was horrified that it didn't matter, you know.
So let me ask you, talking about the word horrifying, of what happened to your nephew, William? He was born, on the day of the funeral of Fred Trump, of your grandfather. Your brother, you call him Fritz, Fred Trump?
Yeah.
Raced off to the hospital with his wife, Linda, and William was born.
Lisa.
And with his wife, Lisa, and William was born. Talk about the tremendous physical challenges he faced within the first 24 hours of birth.
He started having very severe seizures and then ended up in the NICU for quite a while. You know, we had no idea why, or it had been a perfectly normal pregnancy and the birth had been fine. There was no, like, nobody knew anything at first. So you can only imagine just how terrified my sister-in-law and my brother were. And then a couple of weeks after that, we discovered that we'd been disinherited. Which was, you know, bad, but nothing compared to what my brother and sister-in-law were already going through. And it just made everything so much worse because it injected this new level of uncertainty. And, you know, luckily we had had excellent health care from the time we were born. Everybody in the family had health coverage from my grandfather's company for our entire lives. So, you know, that was a real comfort. And our Uncle Robert had written a letter to the insurance company to make it very clear that my nephew would get whatever he needed and it would be taken care of through the Trump management health insurance,
We're coming to the end of the hour, so I wanted to get to this quickly. They assured him of this, but then they took it away, and Donald Trump actually bragged about this infant facing a life of physical challenges and revoking that health insurance?
Yeah, that was in retaliation to the fact that we brought a lawsuit to get, against them, or I should say against my grandfather's estate, because the terms of his will were so egregious that it just didn't seem completely fair. And after 5 months of negotiating with my Uncle Robert, it was clear that nothing, they weren't going to change anything. And, you know, very shortly after we filed the lawsuit, they revoked our health insurance and William's health insurance. And we had to bring another lawsuit to get it reinstated, which we never did.
Mary, before we end, I wanted to ask you about President Trump's attitudes to the LGBTQ community. You write in your book about sitting with your grandma, your gam, as you called her, Marianne McLeod Trump. It was the funeral memorial service for Princess Diana. What did she refer to Elton John as?
She called him the F word, the slur for a gay man.
So, and you were planning at that time to come out to your family, and at least to your grandmother. You made a big decision then not to do that, right? And as we wrap up, I was wondering if you can talk about whether you feel that attitude, that anti-LGBTQ sentiment, was transferred to President Trump, and what you are most concerned about with him.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, homophobia was not something I grew up with simply because, like, homosexuality wasn't discussed, really. But it wasn't surprising to me. I mean, I wasn't happy about it, certainly, that my grandmother had those attitudes. But it didn't exactly surprise me in a household that was so racist, anti-Semitic, and misogynistic. So, you know, by extension, Donald's attitudes towards the gay community aren't surprising. But he's done so much damage in the last 3.5 years, starting with the ban on transgendered troops, that I'm afraid it's going to take a very, very long time for us to regain the ground we've lost.
And can you end by talking about what the separation of children, immigrants on the border, has meant to you, and what you say to your uncle, to President Donald Trump?
To me, that I can't say it was the last straw, because from the Muslim ban on, there have just been new horrors every day or a week. But there was something about that kind of broke me, because we're talking about, it's not just children being kidnapped and their parents are being tortured. If you're a parent, you know what it's like to worry about your child and to have uncertainty about where they are or their well-being. It is literally torture. People are dying in these concentration camps that they set up. What I would say to Donald is, he wouldn't listen to me anyway, but it has to stop. It is antithetical to what this country aspires to be, you know, despite our past around these issues. And people like Stephen Miller, who is should not be anywhere near the executive branch of this country, should be dismissed immediately. And, you know, Donald should maybe think about surrounding himself with people who have some modicum of compassion and empathy, which he won't, which is all the more reason for him not to be in the Oval Office.
We want to thank you so much for spending this hour. Mary Trump, niece of President Donald Trump, clinical psychologist, author of Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. That does it for the show. Stay safe. Wear a mask.